As America grew along the new frontier, many great legends were told.
Dad!
But no legend was greater than the one that surrounded a man of mystery, a man who began as John Reed. Orphaned in an outlaw raid, raised by Indians, and witness to his brother's murder, he made a bond that lasted a lifetime.
I swear to you, Dad, there will be justice in the West.
For he rode to fame.
To this, my brother.
With a mark of a silver bullet.
I pledge my life.
And a black mask across his face. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
My old silver!
Trusted Indian companion, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains, led the fight for law and order. Now the truth is told, the mask is lifted, and the man is revealed in the legend of the Lone Ranger.
Who is that masked man?
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And Chris Franklin is here. Hi, Chris.
Rob, I wish to remain anonymous.
I was going to say, this episode features something rarely heard on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Me and Chris Franklin talking about a superhero movie. in this case, though, it is 1981's The Legend of the Lone Ranger. And there's lots to discuss about this movie in terms of its reputation and things like that. You know, the quick version is this movie was such a flop that it pretty much ruined Lone Ranger, the Lone Ranger as a film property for decades on end. And that formula would be repeated in 2012 with the Johnny Depp version, except they just spent a lot more money.
Yes.
So, but you're kind of here to defend this movie a little bit. You said to me you wanted to talk about this. And I saw this movie for the first time just a couple of years ago, and I wrote a review of it for my blog, my Rob Kelly writing blog. And much like I have talked about other movies like Xanadu and some other movies that have this reputation that they are like the worst thing ever, this thing's not that bad.
No.
I mean, it's not a good movie. I know you're going to defend it, I think, pretty vociferously. I don't think it's a good movie, but it is not the disaster that its reputation suggests.
Yeah, I think this movie had a lot going against it when it was released. For one, yes. Westerns were dead. Two, a lot of bad publicity for this movie. Famously, the Rather Corporation, which owned the Lone Ranger at the time, and you'll see their name in the credits of this movie, they filed suit against Clayton Moore, who was the most famous actor to play the Lone Ranger. He played him on TV for most of the run of the television series in the 50s. He played him in two color live action movies from the 50s that are really good. We should do those sometime, a double feature on those. But they sued him for making public appearances as the Lone Ranger, and he was forced to put away his mask and wear like sunglasses, dark sunglasses, and make appearances as the Lone Ranger. And so that put him on the back foot with that. And then they cast an unknown actor named Clinton Spilsbury as the Lone
Greatest Ranger. Name in the history of cinema.
And I love that the Blu-ray release of this is out right now has his name up top. You know, it's spaced out like he's some big star. It's like Spielberg. Like, yeah. And this guy's pretty notorious because apparently he was a real jerk on the set. Hard to get along with, demanded that all of his scenes be filmed in sequence because he could, so he could get a better grasp of the character, which, you know, movies typically don't do that. He wanted the dialogue changed so he could remember it. And he got in a pretty big, well-publicized bar fight while this movie was being made, which is a big no-no for the moral fortitude of the Lone Ranger. Yeah, this guy was, you know, and pardon my French, but apparently he was so bad that cast and crew members were known to say when he walked away on the set, who was that masked asshole? You know, so.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, I mean, I think that this movie, the critics were gunning for this, no pun intended, were gunning for this movie before it started because of what you just mentioned, that Jack Rather had sued Clayton Moore and to stop appearing as the Lone Ranger. And look, I found this little detail on the Wikipedia page where it mentioned Rather anticipated making a new film version of the story, and he did not want the value of the character being undercut by Moore's appearances at county and state fairs and entertaining children in hospitals. If you find yourself picking on an old man who is wearing a superhero costume to entertain children at hospitals, you're doing something wrong.
Yes.
Like that this movie, even if it had been Superman, to name a movie you and I are vaguely familiar with, even if it had been that good, I think critics would have been wanting to bring this down because Jack Rather screwed up so horribly. I cannot believe that he couldn't figure out a better way to handle that.
Right.
If you're hearing that the Lone Ranger – I mean, first of all, I would say if 25 years after the TV show had gone off the air, the Lone Ranger had enough commercial value that he was still being able to, like, make appearances in county fairs and children's hospitals, that's good.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. That tells you that the character still has some pop culture relevance. It's not like, you know, you don't hear anybody showing up as the Shadow in children's hospitals.
Right.
Or the Green Hornet. So it's like, I see you could have, they could have gone to Clayton Moore and said, look, Clayton, like, we'll put you in the movie. We'll give you a cameo, you know. We'll Kirk Allen it here. But could you cool it on the appearances for just a little while?
Yeah.
But instead, they sued him.
Right.
Which is just such a dumbass move. And so that is why critics were just waiting to savage this movie. And instead, unfortunately, as you mentioned, they cast this unknown Clinton Spilsbury, apparently based on just his looks.
Yeah.
Like that he looked like the character. He looked like a superhero. And I did some research on this movie, and they talked about how that they said at the time they were calling him like the Christopher Reeve of this shoot. They were like, oh, well, it was like Christopher Reeve. We found this unknown who's handsome. Well, yeah, but Christopher Reeve could act. I mean, you know, not only was he ridiculously handsome and he had the right tone to play Superman, but he could act. And Clinton Spilsbury apparently couldn't act.
Yeah.
So much so that they discovered after the film was shot that they had to redub the entire film. So at no point in this film do you hear the voice of Clinton Spilsbury. Nobody knows what he sounds like.
No.
He could sound like Gilbert Gottfried for all we know. I mean, he could be like a Jared Kushner. We have no idea what he sounds like.
I owe Silver Way.
Yeah, exactly. Hello, Tonto. You know what I mean? You have no idea. So he was dubbed entirely by James Keach.
Yes.
And James Keach, you know, when you hear it, you can't unhear it because I'm familiar with what James Keach sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
So the minute you hear him, you just, and it just gives the film an unreality because you know at no moment is the actual voice that anyone is hearing in any given scene the voice of the character. And that's really a problem. Now, I do want to mention the other cast just to kind of set the tone here. We've got Michael Horse as Tonto. This is his first film.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher Lloyd, amazing. Christopher Lloyd, pre-Star Trek III, in a villainous role as Butch Cavendish.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Clark as Sheriff Wyatt. The late Wannon Clay as Amy Stryker. She unfortunately passed away very young. And then the legendary Jason Robards as Ulysses S. Grant. And the film is directed by William A. Fraker, who was actually a very renowned cinematographer. He worked on a lot of amazing movies, but this was like his basically his first feature as a director. And this is one of those movies that proves that just because you work on movies and you know how to shoot movies, it doesn't necessarily mean you know how to make a movie. Now, he also did direct a movie called Monty Walsh with Lee Marvin, which is actually a very good movie. So he was able to, like, he did that movie really well, and then he kind of did nothing for a bunch of years, and then he did this, which was just sort of a big turkey. And this pretty much ended his film career. His one other notable credit in the world of our genre geek stuff is he did direct an episode of The Flash, the 90s Flash TV series.
There you go.
But yeah, but this pretty much killed his career as a director because this thing was such an overwhelming bomb. But it's kind of funny, though. Again, I was looking it up. They spent $18 million on this movie, which is not that bad,
no,
really.
No, for 1981, not bad.
No, it made $12 million, and then they sold it to HBO for $7.5 million. So this thing did make money.
Yeah.
It actually did not lose money for the studio. But it's just one of those movies where the reputation is so profound that anytime it's mentioned, it's just like, oh, it's one of these awful movies. And I don't know. Like I said, it opens up. Well, why don't we talk about, like, why don't you talk about the opening of this movie?
Well, the movie does follow the Lone Ranger legend pretty well, as established by the radio show and the TV series. They don't mess around with the origin much. There's a little changes here and there, but we start off with Lone Ranger John Reed before he's the Lone Ranger. He's a young boy, and he rescues Tonto, who's also, of course, a young boy, from these outlaws. And it turns out the outlaws are burning down the Reed Ranch. And one thing about this movie that's really strange is it's pretty violent. I mean, you see the John's father get shot on his porch and blown back into his house. Their ranch is on fire. They rope his mother and drag her behind a horse. I mean, this looks like the beginning of the outlaw Josie Wales. I mean, it's very similar in a lot of ways, which this movie does have that kind of, you know, modern Clint Eastwood Western look to it. I think that's what they were kind of shooting for, was more of a, a grittier, dirtier Western like that had come up with Clint Eastwood and the spaghetti Westerns, and then, of course, the American Westerns that he had made that had been so popular. And so Tonto takes John to his reservation and to his people, and he learns the ways of the Native American. And I don't think they specifically say which tribe Tonto is a part of, what his people are. I think it's changed over the years, what it's supposed to be exactly. But eventually John's brother, much older brother Dan, comes to get him and take him to live with his aunt in Detroit. And then we come to what is the present of the movie, and John is coming back from Detroit. He has studied to be a lawyer, which is a new wrinkle in the story. And he actually helps stop the stagecoach they're on. He actually helps stop the robbery, which there's this protracted it's a very nicely shot. This is a beautiful looking movie. The cinematography is by Laszlo Kovacs, who was
the great Laszlo Kovacs.
Yeah, who did the cinematography on Inside Moves,
which that was the movie he did just before this.
Yeah, so, and also the music, which is also great, is by John Barry, who had just done Inside Moves, which of Inside Moves obviously is the movie that Rob and I talked about with our personal friend Dick Donner. So
I'm glad you said it, not me.
There's really nice action sequence, but it's a little long, and that's the thing about this movie, the pacing of this movie. I think this movie, you talked about Superman earlier, this movie really wants to be Superman the movie.
Yes.
I think this movie desperately wants to be a Western version of Superman the movie, to the point where, you know, you could almost say, okay, John and the young John and Tonto is the Krypton scene. You know, maybe the parts with, you know, John coming in on the stagecoach or the Smallville scene. And then when you get into, when John later goes and Tonto rescues him, and we'll get into that, that's the fortress scene. And then the rest of the movie's the Metropolis scenes. You know, I mean, you can almost pace it out that way. But unfortunately the pace is a little off because this action sequence is very impressive, but it's a little long. But there was a stuntman who was nearly killed in this sequence, and you can tell that he was nearly killed in this sequence. He tries to do the old jump onto the horses on the wagon, and I guess he was trying to unhitch the wagon or underneath the horses, and it throws him underneath the wagon, and he gets stomped on by the horses and goes flying out underneath the stagecoach, which, wow, it's, I guess they left,
incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, and I guess they left it in the movie because the guy survived, you know, but
hey, we got it, you know.
Right, but I gotta say, we meet Clinton Spilsbury and James Keach, the symbiotic relationship between the two. We meet them in this sequence, and you know, John is immediately smitten with Amy Stryker, who's coming to visit her uncle. I got to say that this is where, I watched it again a couple of times since we decided to do this. I hadn't seen it in several years. Spilsbury isn't as bad as an actor. He's not as wooden as the legend would have you believe. He's not horrible. You know, I don't know what he sounded like, but he does have, you know, a certain amount of charm in his smile. And, you know, I mean, he's not, I've seen worse. You know what I'm saying? Maybe not in the lead of a movie. Well, I don't know. There's Hayden Christensen, but I don't mean to pick on him, but, you know, he's not as awful as I kind of thought I would perceive him with, after having not watched the movie in a few years. But, you know, he helps save Amy from the stagecoach robbers. They were after some government papers, some land grants. So that ties into the plot of the movie. And when they take them back into town, the Cavendish gang is mentioned. And then we find out later that Cavendish is, like you said, played by Christopher Lloyd, who is basically... He is a court-martialed and disgraced major in the Union Army who has decided to secede from the Union and basically take part of Texas with him. that's essentially what he's after. And he's got his grand scheme that involves Ulysses S. Grant. So anything you want to add in this sequence, Rob?
Well, there's a couple of fun things. First of all, the brother. Lone Ranger's brother, Ranger Captain Dan Reed, is played by John Bennett Perry, who is a longtime soap opera actor and the father of Matthew Perry, Chandler from Friends.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Jason Robards, and clearly by casting Jason Robards, they're going for, you mentioned Clint Eastwood Westerns, and I would say that they're also going for Sam Peckinpah. Mm. It's got that look, it's got that gritty, sepia-toned look that also you saw in Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate, although, of course, they don't want to try to imitate that movie. but by casting Jason Robards in your Western, you can't help but try and say, you know, you want people to recall Sam Peckinpah Westerns, which is not a bad thing to try and emulate. And you mentioned the violence in this movie. This movie's rated PG, I think probably because they submitted it to the board, and the board is probably just like, Lone Ranger, that's PG. You know, they probably didn't pay a whole lot of attention to this movie. I would say this probably is a little above being a PG, but they didn't have PG-13 at the time. They're never going to rate it R. Yeah, tonally, it's just a little off, and it takes entirely too long to get to him being the Lone Ranger. You mentioned that it wants to be Superman, and I think that's absolutely true. This movie is only a little over 90 minutes, but he does not become the Lone Ranger until almost like an hour into it. Right. And when he finally does become the Lone Ranger, that's when they finally cue up the theme, the William Tell overture, the most famous theme. And while I could see that you can't possibly not use that because it's like the most famous theme that John Williams didn't write, it tonally, it just doesn't fit with this movie, because this movie is kind of like this adult gritty version of the Lone Ranger story. And yet you've got that, and it just, when I first heard that scene, I'm like, really? Like, you know, it's kind of like, I think the way Sam Raimi worked in the cartoon Spider-Man theme at the end of Spider-Man, like that was, I thought it was a good way of a nod of like, okay, we all remember this great Spider-Man theme, but I don't want to use that in my main movie because we're trying to take this version a little more seriously. I think maybe if they had used it at the end, but by sticking it at the debut of the Lone Ranger, it just feels a little weird. And like, you want to see him and Tonto out there having adventures, and the movie just takes just entirely too long to get to all that. I don't think the romance between him and Amy Stryker, Juan and Clay is... You say you didn't think that Spilsbury's a bad actor. I can't tell. I don't know, because I don't hear his voice.
Well,
I mean,
I mean,
you can see him in the movie, and you can see whether, you know, he seems like he's really present or tuned out. I've seen actors in movies where they just look like they're thinking about their lunch order.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't seem like that. He seems like he's there, and the movie certainly is pretty to look at, as you might expect. Any movie shot by Laszlo Kovacs and directed by a noted cinematographer is going to look nice. And so it does look nice. And that's why when I finally did watch this movie, I didn't come away with it like hating it the way I was expecting to. And Michael Horse as Tonto is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think he's really good. And he went on to have a really long career. He's been on Twin Peaks. He was on the original Twin Peaks, and he was on the revival from last year.
Right.
He did voices on Superman the Animated Series.
Yeah.
And this was his first film, but he went on to a long career. Clint Spilsbury did not. This is literally Clint Spilsbury's only credit, which is kind of amazing to think about. He like was the top line star of a movie, then never again. But I just feel like he's just like a blank to me. And so like I think the metaphor I use is like, this is like a Reese's peanut butter cup where like something went wrong at the factory and the peanut butter's missing, you know? So you bite the chocolate and then there's just nothing. You're like, oh, okay. Like all the movie around the Lone Ranger, I think, is actually pretty good. Christopher Lloyd looks like he's really having a good time digging into being a villain. I mean, it's sort of funny. I remember seeing him in Star Trek III and being like, oh, wow, Jim Ignatowski's a villain. That's cool. I haven't seen that before.
Right.
Well, it's because I hadn't seen this movie. This movie must have not lasted in the theater very long because my dad did not take me to see it.
Yeah.
This would have been something I would have wanted to see at 10 years old.
Yeah.
So this must have just come and gone really quickly. And I don't mean to jump ahead, but in terms of its box office, it was clobbered by Richard Pryor in Bustin' Loose, Alan Alda in The Four Seasons. So we've got Superman and MASH connections right there.
Yeah.
And then just 3 weeks later, Raiders of the Lost Ark opened. So there you go. That was the end of Legend of the Lone Ranger.
If adventure has a name, it's not the Lone Ranger.
It's not the Lone Ranger. And Jason Robards, as Ulysses S. Grant, as you might expect, is terrific.
He's awesome.
He has a lot of fun. The scenes where he's been kidnapped by Cavendish and he kind of like almost has like a friendly relationship with Cavendish, that's a lot of fun. Like, they have a good rapport.
Either playing pool and he's like, you, sir, are a diseased son of a bitch. You know? And then when he says, I love the exchange when he reads him the manifesto he sent into the government that says, you know, if you don't deem me these lands of Texas, then the life of Ulysses S. Grant will be forfeit. And he gives him like 30 days and he's like, and Grant's like, 30 days is much too long. They'll bicker and debate and scratch their indecisive asses and I'll be dead. You know, he tells him to give him less time. I love it. He's fantastic. It's Jason Robards. Of course he's fantastic. But but he is great as Grant. I love the line he's got. You know, that got cussed. He's got on the presidential train. He's got George Armstrong Custer. He's got Buffalo Bill Cody. He's got Wild Bill Hickok with him. And because they're going on some kind of, you know, promotional tour, you know, glad handing people along the way on this train trek through the U.S. And he tells Mexican general comes up and he tells Custer to give him his seat or he'll send him to Montana. So I thought that was pretty good. There's such some really good lines in this one. But, you know, going back, I don't think this movie came to our town either, because I'm pretty sure my dad was a huge Lone Ranger fan growing up, listening to the radio show, watching the TV show. And we watched the TV show. It was like there was a station that showed the Clayton Moore show, which sometimes it was Clayton Moore and sometimes it was John Hart, who John Hart is in this movie as Amy's uncle, who gets killed in this movie. And that's why they go after the Cavendish gang. He was the newspaper publisher that stood up to the Cavendish gang, and they killed him for it.
He played the Lone Ranger at some point?
John Hart did, yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, there's a couple seasons there where Clayton Moore left the series over the contract disputes.
Oh, it says it right here on his Wikipedia page. He replaced Clayton Moore in the television show. I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And what's really strange is, adding insult to injury, is John Hart appears in this movie. He's the one that gets the cameo when he didn't put in as much time as Clayton Moore.
Right. Again. Oh, man.
And yeah, so, I mean, I hate to say that about John Hart because he seems like a nice guy and stuff, but he's almost – I hate to use the word scab, but it's almost like he's, like, crossing the picket line to be – fill in for Clayton Moore every chance he can get. But,
right,
you know,
yeah. He's the asterisk Lone Ranger.
Right, and there was an episode of The Greatest American Hero around this time. I think it's in the first season where John Hart appears at an event, and Ralph Hinckley, William Katt's character, obviously The Greatest American Hero, he goes to see him, and he gives him some kind of sage advice about being a hero in that episode. And so it's like, not only did they not let Clayton Moore to appear as the Lone Ranger, he appears as the Lone Ranger in an episode of The Greatest American Hero. He's playing John Hart playing the Lone Ranger, obviously. But it's like, what did Clayton Moore do to get the ire?
Yeah, wow, yeah.
And by everybody's estimation, Clayton Moore lived the life of the Lone Ranger. I mean, he took it completely seriously, almost to the point of, okay, Clayton, you realize you're just playing the character, right? I mean, like, he was like, he lived by the Lone Ranger code, apparently. So it's really strange. But anyway, aside of all that, we watched the Lone Ranger show. The Lone Ranger had an animated series on at this time. There was the Tarzan Lone Ranger,
right?
Zorro Hour of Adventure that Filmation made. And oddly enough, the character sheets sure do look a lot like Clayton Moore and Jay Silverheels on that animated show.
Hmm.
But it's like, yeah, we'll use your likeness, but you're not allowed to go out and promote, the character. But anyway, but my dad would have definitely have taken me to see this movie. And I remember watching this with him. I think it showed up on, like, when we first got, like, regular cable around, like, 1984. I remember we had WGN, the Superstation out of Chicago, and I believe they showed this movie, and me and him sat down and watched it, and we both thought it was a pretty good update. You know, we liked it. Mm-hmm. And my dad approved of it, which famously did not approve of the Johnny Depp movie and is still mad for me dragging him to the theater, because he hardly ever goes to the movie, and I dragged him to the theater for that, and he's still mad at me for it, which I don't. But my point was that, you know, I personally think that the William Tell Overture and all that stuff works because it's kind of, I don't know, it doesn't work in the way that Superman, like Christopher Reeve and Superman's, you know, moral compass works against the post-Watergate world that he's in Superman the movie. But I think that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to take the kind of square old TV, like Lone Ranger, Roy Rogers, Gene Autry kind of character, and put them in a Sam Peckinpah, Clint Eastwood type Western, and show that the virtuous hero can still save the day, win the day. And so I think that's one reason why they kept the Lone Ranger. You know, he's still, his suit's not as blue as Clayton Moore's. It's more of a gray blue. He's got some of the Native American fringe on it. It's like, so he shows that he was, you know, lived with the Tonto's people twice, you know, and so it kind of shows that. But for the most part, he's still the square, lack of a better term, Lone Ranger in this dirty, more realistic Western world. And I think that's one reason why they stuck with the William Tell Overture. And I think because it's so important to the character, it kind of works. Because I get a real charge when he finally turns around with the damn mask on, and then they have that nice montage of him and Tonto just riding hard across the plains. To me, that's the Lone Ranger, you know. And so that gets me in my, you know, nerdy feels. So it works. And then at the end, when, you know, there's this really nice sequence where they rescue Grant and they blow the hell out of Cavendish's compound. They must have used more pyro, like dynamite and Hollywood pyrotechnics in that scene. I mean, and it's good old fashioned blowing stuff up. I mean, there's actual wooden structures blowing up everywhere. People are flying off of catapults and getting launched in the air. It's fantastic. It's just that old-fashioned, let's just blow some shit up at the end of a Hollywood movie. And I think it works. And I love the bit where, you know, Grant, the Ranger gets Grant up on this trestle and hides him there. And he's like, hey, I could help. I've been in a couple battles myself. And there's one of those times where Keech's vocal presentation really saves. He's like, yeah, well, now you're a president, so stay down. You know, it's like.
Right, right. I like that. That was a good bit. I like that.
That was a nice exchange there. It's like, and Keech's voice really works well. I mean, he's, if you guys have never seen James Keech in a movie, he is he's the motorcycle cop that stops Clark Griswold in the first Vacation movie.
That's right.
With the
That's
dog. Right. Yeah. Yeah. With the, where, you know, where he unfortunately tied the dog to the bumper, which will
poor little mutt.
Yeah. But, so, but, at the end of the movie, I'm getting all excited, but at the end of the movie, all the stuff's blowing up. The cavalry literally runs in, the big gate blows up. And now, I guess you have to assume that Silver and Scout are so smart, the horses, that they went and got the cavalry, and they come in, and you've got, you know, Custer, you've got Hickok and Buffalo Bill riding in with them, and they start taking out Cavendish's army, and Cavendish jumps on his horse and runs off, and Lone Ranger whistles for Silver, hops on, and then the William Tell Overture kicks in, and there's this really cool chase scene and some really good stunt work in this movie. I mean, the Lone Ranger leaps on Cavendish and they go flying off their horses down this hill and beat the hell out of each other for about a minute and it or two. And it's a really nicely staged fight. And, you know, and then of course you've got one of the first times I think I ever remember seeing where a Lone Ranger, like, you know, he's knocked Cavendish out. He actually puts one of his silver bullets in the chamber of his pistol and walks up to him, puts a gun to his head, and of course, Christopher Lloyd, being the great actor he is like, do it, you know, and he's like wanting to get killed in battle, you know, and
yeah, it's a weird moment.
Yeah, and Lone Ranger's like, no, you know, he's not gonna do it because one, he's not gonna kill anybody, and two, no, you're it's much worse punishment for you to rot in a prison or be hung or whatever they're gonna hang him, obviously. You kidnap the president, they're gonna hang him. But yeah, it's a nice little bit, and I love Grant's line to Christopher Lloyd's got this look on his face like, oh well, you know, and he said his jaw's like jotted out and like, you know, like he does with his lip sticking out, and Grant says, your sins will be paid for in the fires of hell. I was like, damn.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
How great would it have been if like that scene, the final scene between the Lone Ranger and Cavendish had been like off a cliff? And the Lone Ranger starts kicking Cavendish in the face, and he's like, I have had enough of you! And he kicks Cavendish off the thing. Christopher Lloyd's like, here we go again! And then he falls. So I'm just trying to make the movie work better. A couple of the things I did want to mention. You mentioned James Keech. My big connection to James Keech is that he is in the Bill Murray adaptation of The Razor's Edge. He plays Gray Maturin, which is ostensibly Lawrence Darrell's best friend in that movie. In fact, he did that right after National Lampoon's Vacation, so that's where I know him from. The actress, the Golden Age of Hollywood actress, Benita Granville, makes a cameo in this movie because she was married to the producer. She was in, so she makes a cameo in the movie. And what do we need to talk a little bit about Merle Haggard.
Yep.
As the balladeer, because they are clearly going for a Dukes of Hazzard feel by having him, you know, do that same kind of, oh, well, the Duke boys are in a whole mess of trouble here. You know, I mean, you can't help but think that they were clearly trying to appeal to that same audience.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have problems with, you know, Merle Haggard sings the song The Man in the Mask repeatedly through the movie, and he kind of sings songs, the narration, as the balladeer, and I do think the Dukes of Hazzard, because Waylon Jennings was doing the Dukes of Hazzard, it's like, oh, let's get right. another big country star. Right. It never bothered me, but I grew up in a house that watched Hee Haw all the time, so I knew who Merle Haggard was. I knew who Waylon Jennings was. My parents listened to country music, so I had no problem, you know, I had no problem with that. Other people I know, like, think that it just, like, ruins the movie, and and takes them right out of it. But I can't. I like Merle Haggard anyway, and I like Waylon Jennings anyway. I listen to their music, so I can't. It doesn't bother me in the least, honestly. But okay. I'm biased. So.
And well, this movie does fill itself out with some nice character actors. I mean, you've got Buck Taylor, who was on Gunsmoke, and you've got Richard Farnsworth, the great Richard Farnsworth, as Wild Bill Hickok.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they have lots of, like, kind of Tom Laughlin, Billy Jack himself makes an appearance in this movie. So, it's, you know, they really did fill it out quite nicely. Again, you mentioned, you made that comparison to Superman, because, and we can't help it because we compare everything to Superman. But, I mean, if you're trying to make a new version of a superhero concept, you couldn't help but try and imitate that formula. And that's clearly what they did. I mean, obviously they did that with Superman. It's like, take an unknown, but surround him with ringers.
Yeah.
Marlon Brando, Gene Hackman, Jackie Cooper, you know, like right. Get all the Ned Beatty, Valerie Perrine. And here's Lone Ranger doing the same thing. We've got this unknown, Clinton Spilsbury, and we're going to surround him with Christopher Lloyd and Jason Robards and Richard Farnsworth. You know, it's like, it makes sense.
Yes.
That you would do it that way. Everything, all the elements are here. Just to me, they just don't gel.
No.
The way they should. And it really, really do have to. I don't want to hang it all on Clinton Spilsbury because that is the director. I mean, when you see a bad performance from an actor, yes, the actor is partly at fault. But it's also the director's fault. That is the director's job, is to step in and say, this isn't working.
Right.
We have to fix something. I mean, that happened on Back to the Future. I mean, you know, Eric Stoltz was fired from that movie because they realized this isn't working. And they, even though they had to reshoot the entire, you know, opening chunk of that movie,
mm-hmm.
that's your job.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really, really is more on the producers and the director for not recognizing quickly, this Spilsbury guy ain't working. We got to stop. We got to redo this. But they didn't, and they just kind of let it go. And so poor Clint Spilsbury is, you know, on the hook for this movie's failure, which is not entirely fair to him. And I read about that, like, when the Depp version came out, apparently, like, reporters, entertainment reporters, like, tracked him down because he's a photographer, I guess, in Los Angeles. So he's not, you know, he's around. It's not like he's living in some hut somewhere.
Right.
And he refused to comment. And I can understand that because he's like, I don't want to just be your monkey.
Right.
You know, where I just come out and I shit on the new version. Who wants to be that? But so I could see why he probably has a kind of bitter aftertaste because he was really kind of hung out to dry.
Yeah.
In this movie.
Yeah. And I think you're right. And when I said that about Hayden Christensen earlier, that was unfair because I understand he's pretty, I've seen him in a couple other things. He's actually pretty decent in it. And, but that's, I mean, that's, again, that was, and I'm not going to jump on the beat up George Lucas, campaign, but they're clearly, like you said, there was something wrong when the performances coming out of the actors wasn't quite up to snuff. So, you know, it's like, I think that's the difference here because, you know, Christopher Reeve rose to the level of the other actors he was with because he's that good of an actor and because yes. Richard Donner is yep. that good of a director.
Yep.
Clinton Spilsbury did not, you know, I mean, he's, yep. he's okay and he's not as bad as some people would have you believe just because he's not, he does like you said, he does seem engaged in the movie. I mean, he is there, he's in the scene, you know, he's not like you said, oh, I want to order lunch or whatever, but you know, there's some good stuff. Some couple scenes in here that I wanted to bring up just real quick.
Sure.
The Bryant's Gap scene, which is the origin of Lone Ranger. That's where the Rangers are ambushed. That's really well shot and choreographed. Maybe drags on a little too long when they're setting it up. I mean, I think they could have cut out a couple of minutes of them wandering in between the rocks, you know. Again, it's a little, you know, and could have got us to a little more Lone Ranger action quicker and had a little more Lone Ranger in it. But it's really well done. Of course, very violent. I mean, there's these men are just getting mowed down and mercilessly. And again, it's like I think this is you know, if Temple of Doom hadn't gotten us a PG-13 rating and a few years later, you know, it's it's kind of that same thing. You know, it's like this is kind of on the edge of a PG. Of course, back then, PG could get you nudity, too.
That's right.
Which is very strange. You know, that scene's really neat. One scene I want to point out is when he does become the Lone Ranger, me and my dad always like to pick on this. If you watch a Clayton Moore Lone Ranger show, which we love him, and, of course, Jay Silverheels, who was also Native American, to play Tano. And actually, almost everybody who played Tano was a Native American except Johnny Depp. So it's like they got that right for so many years. whereas other Native American characters were played by, you know, Italian actors, or, well, I mean, even Iron Eyes Cody, you know. But Tonto was almost, I think, in the movie serials and, of course, Jay Silverheel's full-blooded Native American, which is great and is always the way it should have been. But I always, you know, me and my dad joke about how in the old movies, or the old TV show and in the movies, Lone Ranger would send Tonto into town, in this town full of bigoted people. He would send Tonto in. It's like, you know, Tonto, I want you to go into town and see what's going on. Kimosabe, good plan. They won't mind Indian with buckskin and guns and knife come in town, you know, snoop around, you know, that's the way Tonto talk. And it's like, Tonto, when you get captured, I'll come by and shoot the rope when they're trying to hang you. You know, and because one reason we
cut it a little close, Kimosabe.
Yeah, Kimosabe, you cut real close. And I'm not. That's how Jay Silverhill's talked as Tonto, guys. I'm not making fun of. You know, that's how he talked.
That's how Frankenstein talks. That's how Tarzan talks. It's a whole bit on Saturday.
Yeah, and I love Jay Silverhill's as Tonto, but despite his limited speech they gave him, he still infused that character with a lot of nobility, and you could tell the friendship between him and the Lone Ranger was real. So I'm not picking on him. I love that show. But anyway, they lift the scene in this movie. Lone Ranger, Tonto is getting hung because, you know, Collins, who betrays the Rangers to Cavendish and gets them all killed, he is shot before he can tell Lone Ranger what's going on, and Lone Ranger and Tonto duck out, but they capture Tonto, and the sheriff who's working, Sheriff Wyatt, who's played by Matt Clark, who's in a lot of Clint Eastwood movies and in Back to the Future Part 3 with Christopher Lloyd.
There you go, which is a Western.
Which is a Western, of course. They're going to hang Tonto, and, you know, Lone Ranger rides into town, shoots Tonto's noose as they're about ready to drop him. Tonto jumps on the horse, and they ride off. That's lifted directly from the first Lone Ranger movie with Clayton Moore and Jay Silverheels, the color movie from 56. The only difference is Clayton Moore gets a little extra crafty and sets a wagon full of hay on fire and distracts everybody, then comes through and shoots Tonto loose and they ride off. So, but they lifted some, you know, some elements for that. That's a really cool scene. And they play the William Tell Overture there. So, but
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Does it bother you that in this version, he's not a Texas Ranger? He's a brother of a Texas Ranger. In the classic Lone Ranger, he's the last of the Texas Rangers.
Yeah, that part I don't understand.
I wonder why they changed that. That seems weird to me.
I mean, he deputizes him hastily while they're, you know, right before they get killed. So he's like a ranger for about 5 minutes before they're all shot. The rest of them killed, and technically John Reed stays dead, of course. That I don't understand. I guess the reason they did that was to try to explain why he was so by the book and law and order, and not just a merciless vigilante that like shot to kill. You know, because Lone Ranger, even in this movie, just shoots them in the hand and shoots the guns out of their hands, which, like my dad always said, if you shot people in the hand, you'd have a West full of people with like crippled hands, holes in their hands, you know, with a
bloody stump town.
Yeah, exactly. It is kind of odd. And the weirdest thing, the dumbest thing they do, in my opinion, as far as the legend, is when, Tonto finds John Reed. We're bouncing all over the story, but Tonto finds John Reed. He's the only one that's still alive. He's barely alive. He nurses him back to health. He recognizes the necklace he gave him as a boy and recognizes him as his Kimosabe, you know, trusted friend, or sometimes it means trusty scout. He recognizes that's his old friend. He takes him back to his camp, nurses him back to health, and he teaches John how to use a gun. He can't shoot for shit, basically. And so Tonto gives him silver bullets because they use silver in their arrows and they fire clear and it's silver is true. And if a Native American tribe had all that silver, why are they living the way they do? Why can't they just? Mm. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. In the original story, the Reeds owned a silver mine. They had a deed to a silver mine. That's where Lone Ranger got his bullets. That's how he was able to finance his crusade, how they had supplies, how he didn't have to have a job. Dan's son, who he mentions in this movie, ends up being, of course, that's Lone Ranger's nephew. He ends up meeting his nephew. They have adventures together. And Dan ends up being, as far as the radio program goes, the father of the Green Hornet.
Right. It's all one big universe.
And he founds the Daily Sentinel newspaper with the money from the silver mine. So, you know, that's how the Reed family set up. So it doesn't make any sense for Tano's tribe to have a silver mine, but it makes a lot of sense for the Reeds to have a silver mine. So
I did like that little detail. I mean, sometimes we can get a little too much up inside our own posteriors with making everything one giant universe.
Yeah.
But I do kind of enjoy that the Green Hornet is a descendant of the Lone Ranger. It's just a fun little nod that if you know it, you're like, oh, Reed and Reed. That's cool. I like that.
Well, they were created by the same guys on the same radio station out of Detroit.
Right.
So it makes sense. George W. Trendle and Fran Stryker, which is why Amy and her uncle are named Stryker after.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. That's so cool. I do want to mention one thing about, since you mentioned Amy Stryker, I mentioned that Juanine Clay, she's okay in this movie. Like, she's great. She unfortunately passed away very young, as I mentioned. She was in the running to play Wilma Deering on Buck Rogers.
Oh, wow.
Obviously she did not get it, and it was Erin Grave, and that is something David Ace Gutierrez is very happy about. But so she came close. There is an anecdote I wanted to mention as we sort of wrap up here, just to reiterate about how cruel Hollywood can be, because it mentioned sneak previews only fueled the growing enthusiasm for this movie. At one screening in San Diego, people dressed up as the Lone Ranger and Western costumes. During the movie, when the Lone Ranger vows to avenge his brother and the William Tell Overture kicks in, the theater erupted. Sid Sheinberg, the president of Universal, who was sitting next to the producer, looked over and said, "It's previewing better than Jaws." It's just, oh, no. You know, it's just,
wow.
Like, oh, man, you were in for a rude awakening, Mr. Sheinberg. This movie does have a very nice poster. I, for some reason, despite my graphics background, and you, of course, you have one too, I never really talk about the art very much on these episodes. It just doesn't occur to me to. But this is a really slick poster.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a nice shot of him holding the silver bullet. In a black field. It's maybe a little bit of like of a downer image in terms of it's so heavily dark, but I think it looks cool. I think it's a nice image. I think it's a good way to help sell the idea of the Lone Ranger, and of course it would be something that they would use on some merchandise, but we will get to that in a moment. The final thing I do want to mention, there is a Legend of the Lone Ranger movie novelization. Back then, of course, they made novelizations of everything. And I bought it. I bought it on eBay in anticipation of this recording. And there's a line that it has the same problems as the screenplay, as you might imagine. It just takes too damn long for the Lone Ranger to pop up. It's about 160 pages, and like he doesn't become the Lone Ranger until page 110. But nevertheless, there's a line here that I actually thought was really effective. And it's after his brother's been killed and the Texas Rangers have been slaughtered. And it says, "He stood, placed his hat back on, and slowly turned to face his Indian friend. He wore a black leather mask, soaked wet with his own tears and Captain Dan Reed's blood." I thought, like, that line really jumped out at me as very effective. Like, it really had some grit, and it really centered to me the Lone Ranger character of, like, that he's out for – he's very similar to Batman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very Batman-y origin of, like, I'm going to make sure that people don't violence isn't visited upon people the way it was to me and my family.
Right.
And I wish the movie almost had an element to me as powerful as that one line.
Yeah.
You know, like the book was mostly kind of just like, okay, yeah, it's just a lot of detail that we don't need. But that just jumped right out of me. So it's kind of a fun little detail that they threw it in there.
That's
so,
nice.
Thank you for you. I think you mentioned it. That there was a novelization or something, and I found it on eBay for like $2.
Oh, so cool.
I couldn't resist. So is there anything else we want to say about Legend of the Lone Ranger? We actually got more out of this than I thought. I thought we would bang through this very quickly.
You and I get to talking and we can't shut up. I will mention a couple more things. One, the Lone Ranger, as far as I know, has always made he's supposed to have made his mask from his brother's vest. And that's why they show him holding the vest in the movie. So that's why that keys into that line in the book. So that it literally is Dan Reed's blood on the vest, on his mask. One thing I wanted to point out that I thought was really interesting, James Keach was married to Jane Seymour.
Of course.
And two of their children, they have two children, one named John. Well, his godfather was Johnny Cash. And I am a huge fan of Johnny Cash, and I believe you are too, fan of Johnny Cash. And their other son was named Chris, and his godfather was Christopher Reeve.
Oh, my God!
And, of course—
That's crazy!
Of course, Johnny Cash guest starred on Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman several times. And, of course, yes, Jane Seymour and Christopher Reeve were great friends.
In Summer Time,
which we need to talk about at some point, yeah.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine? If Christopher Reeve had been my godfather, well, it wouldn't have happened because I was alive before he got famous. But I would just be bugging him all the time.
Yeah.
I would have been talking to him just endlessly, like, kid, shut up. Stop asking me about Superman. Let's talk about Remains of the Day, for Pete's sake.
Yeah.
Wow. What a great – oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
That's lovely.
Yep.
That's lovely. That's a great detail. So, yeah, that is going to do it for Legend of the Lone Ranger. Like I said, it's not. I don't think it's a particularly great movie. Chris is more positive on it than me, but it is not. Again, I will say, like I said about Xanadu a couple of episodes ago, it is not the sinkhole of awful that its reputation suggests.
No.
And so I would think that if you're interested, I think it works as a curio. It's an interesting idea that what might maybe could have happened if it had really taken off. Clearly that was in the air of the idea of making sort of adult reboots of these characters. I mean, the Greystoke Legend of Tarzan would come down a couple of years after this. And so, you know, it's the least successful of those attempts, but it's just not as bad as what you've heard. So if you can find it, it's on, as you mentioned, it's on Blu-ray, for Pete's sakes. It's on, you can rent it on streaming and stuff. Give it a try. So that's going to do it for Film and Water. But we're not quite done talking about The Legend of the Lone Ranger, are we, Chris?
No, we are not, because over on FW Presents, we're going to do an episode of Those Wonderful Toys where we talk about Gabriel's Lone Ranger lines, both the Legend of the Lone Ranger and the Lone Ranger line that preceded it. So that should drop the very next day. So check that out on the feed.
Yes, it's going to be part two of this. So let's wrap it up. Chris and I don't need to plug all our shows. You all know what we – you all know we're all here in the network. We do shows together. We do shows separately. We have all sorts of stuff going on in the Fire and Water Podcast Network. So come back tomorrow for part two, where we will talk about the Lone Ranger toy line. So I'm excited to talk about that because I love talking about toys. I love the WT show, and I'm happy to be on it. So let's wrap this one up, and let's get to talking about some toys. So we will see you all tomorrow. And until the next episode of Film and Water, that's a wrap.
Return with us now to the exciting days of the old Wild West with these Lone Ranger sets. Will the wagon train be ambushed by renegade Indians? Will Butch Cavendish get away with the Carson City payroll? Will the Lone Ranger and Tonto arrive in time to save Danny? Or is it too late? The Lone Ranger by Louis Marks. How it ends is up to you.